Trigger warning. This sermon is about venomous snakes. Bonus trigger warning. This sermon is about venomous snakes sent from God. Extra bonus trigger warning. This sermon is about venomous snakes sent by God to bite God's own precious, vulnerable, hungry, thirsty, wilderness-weary people. Up to this point in Israel's wilderness wanderings, the people have aimed their complaints at Moses. They complained to Moses about the water being bitter. 3 days out here without water, and finally you give us this nasty stuff to drink. What kind of prophet? How did you even graduate seminary? They complained to Moses about the food. What is this fried mush again? I'd rather go back and be a slave than eat this slop. Later, they complained to Moses about all their misfortunes, and they tack on a very negative Yelp review again about the food. We used to eat fish for free in Egypt, and oh man, do you remember those cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the garlic and the onions? Oh man. And you may recall at this point is when Moses pleads with God for the sweet taste of death. Put me to death at once, he says to God, if I have found favor in your sight. It's kind of an old-fashioned way of saying, kill me now, God. And as they go, God responds in different ways to the Israelites' complaints. There are divine provisions. When they complain of the bitter water, God provides. God shows Moses how to sweeten the water with a special tree. When they complain about the food, God rains bread from heaven and sends quail for meat. Later on, they're thirsty again. Everybody's thirsty. Mom's thirsty. Kids are thirsty. Livestock's thirsty. Everybody's thirsty. And God shows Moses just the right spot to strike the rock and bring forth water, provision. But some of their complaints result in punishments. When Moses' siblings and colleagues, Miriam and Aaron, complain against their poor brother, God afflicts Miriam with leprosy for a week. I don't know why Aaron got out of that, but Miriam really got it for a week. She was down. And after a faction in the congregation tries to oust Moses and get another preacher, God sends a plague on 10 of the spies who were complicit. Remember that. When others rebel against Moses, God opens the earth and swallows all the offenders and with, quote, their households and all the people who belong to Korah with all their possessions. Feeling more secure? Yeah. Provision. God is a loving God. But also punishment. God is a judging God. And provision and punishment compose the thresholds of Israel's journey through the wilderness. But when we get to the narrative for today, the situation unfolds like a horror movie. Now the Israelites complain not only against Moses, but this time they add God. Now God is in the crosshairs of Israel. And just like in a horror movie when you see the main character about to go in there and you say, no, stop, don't go in there. Well, they go in there. And they complain, why have you, to God, why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? And like a frustrated, picky eater, tired of leftovers, they look at their plate of provision and they say, there's nothing to eat. And that's when God says, I've had enough. Send in the snakes. I've always imagined this is kind of a snakes on a plane type scenario with broods of vipers approaching like an invading army and jumping all over them and snakes falling out of the overhead bins and kind of like whoever the Israelite version of Samuel L. Jackson was standing up saying, I'm tired of all these snakes. But I wonder if that's not how it happened. Numbers doesn't specify a specific species of snake, though to this day in that region between Egypt and Israel, there's something called a desert horned viper. And you can't make this up. It's a snake with little devil horns on its head. This exists. And it hides in the sand and it bites you when you unwittingly step on it. And I'm convinced this is the kind of snake that it was. The caravan's walking along, don't see any snakes, and all of a sudden you feel the burning in your ankles, the burn of the toxin. In fact, there's a play on words in the text about fiery serpents. These are seraph serpents. These are fiery serpents. So whether they had horns or not, I don't know. They were certainly on fire. What kind of God does this? What steadfast, loving, compassionate God would orchestrate something so mean? Later in the Sermon on the Mount, you remember when Jesus asked the disciples, is there anyone among you who, if your child asked you for bread, would give them a stone? Or if they asked you for a fish, you'd give them a snake? Well, Jesus, there was that one time. Punishment. And yet provision. In the midst of the punishment, God provides the antivenin, just as a modern-day medicine derives the antidote to venom by processing the very venom itself and lifting it up on an IV drip to restore us to health. So God directs Moses to put a snake on a pole and lift it up for the people so that anyone bit might look on it and live. There is this punishment to be sure, but to be sure there's also provision. God provides a means to life derived from the very source of death. Now, isn't this just a bunch of primitive magic? Strange religious syncretism? Some delirious desert tribe committing an abomination, some sacrilegious combination of a Canaanite snake idol with worship of the living God? Didn't the Israelites learn their lesson from the golden calf? But now, by God's own direction, Moses is firing up the furnace to burnish a bronze snake. What? But I wonder if it doesn't shed some light on this strange text by saying God's hostile act is not retribution for, but a consequence of, the people's ingratitude. Once the enemy has arrived, the only way to live again is to look the enemy in the eye. Do you remember Jacob? After a frightful night of wrestling with probably God, some kind of divine being, strange God. Jacob is about to face his arch nemesis, his own brother, Esau, and possibly death at his brother's hands. That's what he deserved. And Jacob awakens. He sees Esau coming with 400 some others coming for him across the horizon. Jacob scurries to send his family and his servants away to meet his maker alone. And then comes Esau, the source of Jacob's fear. And surely Esau has come back to bite him. But when they meet, Jacob looks on Esau and says, "For truly to see your face is like seeing the face of God." I like Anne Lamott's version of the saying you've probably heard. Not forgiving is like drinking rat poison and waiting for the rat to die. Jacob's been downing this poison for years. Punishment. The only antivenin left is to look his old enemy in the eye. Provision. Life. We may be tempted, though, still to say, well, that's no God for me. That's the vile and Old Testament God. You know, I don't have any use for that antiquated, primitive tribal God. Give me the loving God of the New Testament. Give me the forgiving God of Jesus Christ. He doesn't send any snakes to bite people and kill people. I don't want this old God. Give me the New Testament God. Not so fast. Another trigger warning. Jesus' bite stings and burns too. When Jesus called us to suffer, we too fell away in large numbers. When he struck our head with the sword of his mouth, we struck his head with a crown of thorns. When his words burned us, we bound him to a pole. Jesus came to us many times with stinging messages. Oh, you're first. Well, you'll be last. I came not to bring peace, but a sword. You faithless and perverse generation, how much longer must I put up with you? Let the dead bury their own dead. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, for you're like whitewashed tombs. Jesus fashions a whip of cords and drives out the money changers and flips the tables. Tear down this temple, he says, and I'll rebuild it again in 3 days. Stumbling upon the disciples who couldn't keep their eyes open for 10 minutes. As death closed in on him, are you still asleep? We forget sometimes that Jesus came to us as enemy. He was and is hostile to our ingratitude, our indifference, our lack of faith. We were and are hostile to him, perceiving him as a threat from the beginning. Remember what they tried to do to Jesus at his very first sermon? Now, it wasn't a very nice sermon. He did not identify with his congregation very well. He didn't have 3 points or a poem. And they tried to run him off a cliff. I mean, they tried to kill him. The hometown boy. Man. And once we realized he came to save us from ourselves, we never stopped conspiring against him. But God unleashes Jesus to bite us and to rescue us. Now, that may sound grating. Jesus? A snake? A serpent? Well, Ephraim the Syrian, you may remember him from the great best-selling hits of hymns that he wrote in the 4th century. He called Jesus the spiritual serpent. Jesus is both pain and potion, both punishment and provision. The only one with power to judge us is the only one with power to save us. Do you remember this too? When even after his resurrection, the disciples don't see him coming. They step on him without knowing it. And they say to this stranger, oh, how we'd hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel, but now he's nowhere to be found. And the stranger replies, oh, how foolish you are and how slow of heart. And then he appears to them in the breaking of the bread, and what do they say? Were not our hearts burning within us while he was talking to us on the road? Oh, so many ways that we could consider our own journeys taking awful turns. You may be thinking of an example right now in your own heart of some awful time in your life where things went from bad to worse and then got far worse. Low-hanging fruit, really, for most of us. We could say low-hanging fruit for our congregations. Many congregations today could say the same thing, feeling like we're in the wilderness, getting hit again and again, and getting frustrated and feeling like, is this going to be like this? Is God going to keep sending these challenges and these crises to us? We can get frustrated and express our ingratitude, but what if we did the opposite? What if even in the worst possible time, something in us awoke and we began to say thank you? What if each one of us was equipped to say out of a story like this even, when the hammer comes down, or the gauntlet is thrown, the crisis comes, the pain burns, we're still able to say, thank you, God. Thank you, God, or even though I was in captivity, you let me go. Thank you, God, even though I was a slave to sin and death, you rescued me. Thank you, God, that even when my life came crashing down around me and I was in great pain, you came to me with a balm. Gracious God, thank you for lifting me up. Thank you for giving me life. Thank you for counting every hair on my head. Thank you for knitting me together in my mother's womb. Thank you for giving me a calling and a purpose. Thank you for giving me family and friends and breath. Thank you, God, for even though I am in this pain, you breathe the breath of life into my nostrils. Thank you, God, for everything. For the highs and the lows, we who suffer in the wilderness of life, full of complaints, frustrated, feeling like we're getting nowhere, wishing we could go back to the way things were, how the injustice of it all does burn us. But hear the good news. Our salvation has been lifted up from the earth. Look on him.